Welcome to The Good Stuff with Sonoma County Wine Growers. I'm Virginie Boone alongside Carissa Cruz, President and CEO of the Sonoma County Wine Growers. We're here to talk about what makes Sonoma County such a special place to grow, make, and enjoy wine.
Happy New Year!
And it's a new year. It's 2025.
Woo woo.
But true confession.
Yeah, true confession. We are pre-recording this because today, while you are all listening to this, I will be down in the Coachella Valley, Palm Springs, the desert, at the Cactus Cup. I know.
I love it.
The Cactus Cup. So we talked about it right before the holiday, the New Year holiday, that Sonoma County Wine Growers has a new partnership with the Coachella Valley Firebirds minor league hockey team and AcroShore Arena. And this weekend, the January 3rd and 4th, the Cactus Cup College, there's a college hockey tournament is happening, and we are the presenting sponsor for that as part of this kind of global partnership, and we will be pouring wine and watching college hockey.
Do they actually win a cup that's made from a cactus?
I have no idea. I'm going to have to report back on our next show because, yeah,
and
remains to be seen.
If so, do they drink milk out of it, or
I'm pretty sure now that we're the presenting
maybe
sponsor,
County wine?
I'm pretty sure that they're at least going to have some wine poured on them.
Okay, so maybe you should be ready for that.
I know,
and have a couple magnums.
To
throw into the cup.
I might throw that into my suitcase now.
Although some of the winners may be underage,
I was going to say,
you don't need to check IDs.
Yeah, no, that's on them.
They play hockey. They're tough. They probably drink a lot of beer.
And if I just, like, you know, shake up a bottle of sparkling and, like, pour it on them.
You could just do that.
You don't have to be 21 for that. To have champagne dumped in your, you know, sparkling, Sonoma County sparkling
wine. We don't
ask
questions.
Yeah. Why would we?
Okay.
So that's happening.
Yep.
So, literally now.
What else is coming up for the wine growers?
Oh, gosh.
A busy January?
We have so much going on now. January just completely ramps up. So we have our big annual meeting coming up. We're doing it virtually on January 16th, which is great. We've learned coming kind of out of 2020 and 2021, just kind of those big conferences or meetings are harder and harder to get folks at. So we have a lot of luck, I should say, with virtual meetings. So we'll be doing Dollars and Cents on January 16th. And then we have two major activations. We're supporting two of Sonoma County's main varietal wines. We'll be back in Palm Springs for Passion for Pinot at the
end
of January.
I hear.
Yes. Yeah. And then also at the end of January / February 1st, we will be with our partners from Zap at sort of Zin X, which is happening kind of a VIP-only version of that event, 300 people over at Copia in Napa Valley. So we will have our pouring Zin here, and then pouring a lot of Pinot down south, and actually doing a masterclass on Sonoma County Pinot. So it's like from Carneros to West Sonoma Coast, getting to try Pinot Noirs from all the major AVAs that grow Pinot Noir.
Do you remember some of the wines that will be featured? Or
that is
to
a
be
great
determined?
Question. I do not.
Put you on the spot.
That is a little far out. You know, I'm kind of a just in time. Just in time. Yeah, but we will be doing the masterclass, which I think is going to be really, really great. And I know we have a couple of winemakers, I believe like Amy Chenoweth, coming down with us. I don't know if our guest, we can ask him, but I think James McVale might be down there, potentially on the panel as well, since he's the winemaker for The Calling. He's going to be our guest today.
Yeah, well, yeah, speaking of, I mean, definitely a very skilled winemaker when it comes to Pinot Noir, James McVale. Winemaker, as you said, for The Calling Wines. He's also the winemaker for San Giacomo Family Wines, where he makes a little Pinot and Chardonnay for them as well. McPhail Family, his original brand, which is now his brand again. We'll talk to him about that. And another brand that he started kind of when McPhail was not his, called Tongue Dancer Wines. And then he's got a client I've never heard of. We'll have to ask lots of questions called We Know Jack.
I know.
Exclamation point.
I do not know Jack. So we shall meet Jack on when we finally start to talk to him. Yeah. So I mean, January is always such an exciting time, I think, because it's just like the reset of the year. And so we're going to continue too. We have our Houston Rockets partnership is in full gear. So we'll be heading back to Houston in middle of January. So January, I think, 21st, 22nd, 23rd. Third, they do their large MVP, so most valuable partners. see what happened there? Partners.
Okay.
Event, which is really fun. So for us, we get to go, and it's all the players are there and the coaches and some of their alum. And we get to meet all their other partners, which actually a lot of business gets done. So that's where we met the folks from Kroger stores, grocery stores last year, and working on doing something with them. So it's actually a great kind of mix and mingle. So we have that going on in January too. So we're going to be all things sports and then be gearing up for the start of the baseball season. So with the Giants. So
this is why it's important to play in all sports.
Right. So we've got the Bears are going to be wrapping up, and then you've got, you know, hockey in full season. You've got basketball in full season, and then we'll be starting our baseball. So,
okay. Well, we'll be right back to talk about wine here on The Good Stuff. We are in studio on The Good Stuff with our guest today, James McPhail. It's going to take me a couple minutes to explain all the things that you do. So you're owner and winemaker, McPhail Family Wines and Tongue Dancer Wines. And then you also are the winemaker for The Calling, San Giacomo Family Winery. And we know Jack, exclamation point, which
I don't know nothing about.
I don't know
we
Jack.
We don't know Jack.
So we're going to need some, you're going to have some splaining to do, Mr. McPhail.
Okay.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
You got a lot going on.
I do. Busy, but it's good.
Yeah, busy, but it's good. So you are a Northern California kid, is my understanding from your bio. But you've been at this winemaking thing for a little bit.
I'll be 30 years next year.
Wow. Congrats.
Wow. Just kidding.
That's impressive. That's impressive. Did you always want to be a winemaker?
Start at the beginning. Tell us about
your childhood.
Well, grew up in Marin County, you know, with a family that's been there for many generations. Business started in 1880. And thought that I was going to have to go continue the family business. Mm. And so went to school for business. And then went into a career in my early 20s that I hated. And...
Okay, you have to share what it was.
What was that?
you don't get away with that.
I was in the hotel business.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and at the time I was with the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something else. Mm. I'd grown up in a very artistic family, played multiple instruments.
I heard.
Very artistic house.
We're coming back to those instruments in a minute.
Most important, I think, from childhood was that my father taught my sister and I about wine. I grew up around the very European table where food was taught as it should be, as wine was taught as it should be, that it's part of the meal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That it is food.
It is food. And so my mom and dad would have half a bottle one night and finish it the next night, give my sister and I the half water, half wine on special occasions.
Yes.
And so I really got it into my blood. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a favorite as a kid?
So I remember stopping at a wine shop in San Rafael on my way home. My dad would give me a ride home from high school. Went to school down in San Rafael. And he would stop at the wine shop and go in and spend like a fair amount of time, I remember, like looking at the shelves and talking to the buyer. And I just found myself being really fascinated with like wine labels and I guess listening to my dad.
Yeah, all the different regions,
all the
countries.
Regions. Yeah, so it was instilled early. And unfortunately, my parents passed away in my early 20s, which was one of the reasons how I ended up going into wine. But I never got a chance to ask him, what was your, fascination with Burgundy or wine, so...
Would they travel around wine or not really?
So my dad was an adventurer. Whenever I couldn't find him at lunchtime, he would be at the bookstore on 4th Street in Santa Fe in the travel section, sitting on a chair, like reading travel books.
Thinking about that.
Where to go.
So I grew up really having some pretty amazing travels around the world. Mm. My dad would take my sister and I out of school day after we were out, and we would be, on a ship to Russia or something.
Oh, wow.
Really. I mean, just really.
Like no one does.
Right, exactly. No, really. I mean, just really You know, back then it was still communist, you know, but he had no fear, just a real sense of adventure. And he wanted to show, I think he just wanted to show my sister and I, you know,
the world.
And so were there particular places that really spoke to you on these travels? I mean, Russia was probably fascinating.
Russia was pretty fascinating. It was a month on a Russian ship, 30 days.
Wow.
And we were the only English-speaking, there was one other English-speaking person on the ship, and it was a British guy that ran the gift shop.
Wow. Yeah. Did you drink vodka and eat a lot of caviar?
So every single morning for 30 days, even though my father said no, they came around with a tray of vodka for breakfast.
Yeah. Stop it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're hardcore.
And my sister and I ended up in the bar every night, of course. And I remember some really fun, like watching Tom and Jerry cartoons in Polish with some other subtitle. And we would drink, you know, because there was nothing else to do on a ship in the middle of
that. That's very true.
I think you gave us a new marketing idea, James. I think we should now work with all the hotels locally, and they should deliver a little glass of wine first thing in the morning.
I don't see why all of that's our guests. Not happening already.
Yes. Start your day off right.
I know, really.
Mm. I mean, we're doing it all wrong.
Yeah. Every single morning, I remember passing by, they'd offer vodka. My dad would say no.
So the memories of that trip are a little vodka-fueled in a good way, sounds like.
But there was wine, and, you know, there was always wine on the table. Like, wherever we traveled, my dad would always have wine with the meal.
Yeah.
That was first and foremost.
Okay.
Yeah.
So somewhere along the line, though, I remember you saying that you were, was it studying to be a concert pianist?
I was trained as a concert pianist from the age of 4. Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
He just drops this.
I know. I was like, I was drinking vodka on a ship headed to Russia, and then I was trained as a
concert pianist. Did you have to play on the ship? Was this like part of your...
Oh, my gosh. No, but I played... It wasn't competition, but there was a lot of recitals, a lot of kind of prestigious recitals that I traveled around to perform in. And I remember some trips I had to find the piano to practice.
Yeah, I really? Bet. Yeah.
It was very strict.
So was this something that you loved or something that your parents loved for you?
My parents loved for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did your sister have to do violin?
So, well, actually, no, I take that back. I mean, I do love playing the piano. It was pretty intense in my childhood, so there's a little little PTSD,
sure.
You know?
Sure.
But I have the Steinway Baby Grand that I was, you know,
beautiful
taught on in the house. Mm. And Carrie brings up, you know, every once in a while, so, you know, you're going
to play a few
tunes?
You're
going to play again? So I'm easing back into it.
Okay.
Is it easy to remember?
It is. It's like riding a bike.
Because you were young. Yeah. Yes. Really young when you started.
Yeah. I played for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about bagpipes?
So that was the instrument that I think my parents loved for me to play. So I don't know if you remember, grew up in a family business, McPhail's, and there was an opening of an appliance store on Lakeville in Petaluma. And I remember, I do remember this, I think I was 8 years old, and they had a bagpiper. So where's McPhail, you know, Scottish.
Uh-huh.
And it was the grand opening. For those of you locally that know, it's the Goodwill store now, right? You know where the Goodwill store is on Lakeville?
Maybe, yeah.
In and out, okay. And then you know. So that was originally built as a McPhail's appliance store. So anyway, according to the legend, my mom said that, I said something to her like, oh, I love those. Or I like those or something. So next thing I knew, I was
playing the bagpipes.
up close and personal with the bagpipes.
As one does. So I ended up playing for the Prince Charles Pipe Band, San Francisco, for 15 years. Traveled.
That's serious. That's not like hobby.
Yeah, no, traveled all over the world. Played for the Queen of England.
Wow.
1984 when she came and first time she'd been, I think, to America in a long time. And the Prince Charles Pipe Band was chosen to play for her in Davies Symphony Hall, which had just opened at the time.
Yeah,
and we were sequestered on Treasure Island and ushered into a big bus and then dropped off in the back door of the Davis Symphony Hall and went in. I was told, like, right before that I was going to play Amazing Grace.
Wow.
And it was a time when I would play it solo and then the band would, you know, kick in. So, yeah.
You played solo for the Queen.
Yeah, Amazing Grace.
How many kilts do you own?
None that fit me.
How many kilts did you own when you had to, did you have to wear a kilt for the solo?
Oh, yeah. No, I had full dress. Mm. We call it full dress, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
So what was harder, piano or the bagpipes?
Oh, bagpipes by far.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You really have to.
Not an easy instrument.
Feels like it's heavy, too.
It is. They are heavy, and you don't start playing the bagpipes. You actually start on the chanter to learn the fingering and everything else, and then, because you got to get that down before you can get all the other mechanics of the instrument down. Mm. I think I remember hearing something like it was the second hardest instrument after the French horn or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Something. Anyway.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you remember a popular bumper sticker at one time that said, play a bagpipe, go to jail? That's the law.
Seriously?
There really was one. I remember because a good friend of mine, her dad was a judge, and he had that on his car, which was particularly funny because he was a judge. And I was just like, are they picking on people that play bagpipes? Yeah. I guess so.
Well, I mean, really. I mean, come on. Growing up as a kid playing bagpipes, you can imagine.
You were super cool.
All the girls loved you. Just funny. So popular. But no,
I mean, that or football. I mean, whatever.
Right? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So you can imagine a 14, 15-year-old boy wearing a kilt in front of all his clothes. Yeah, it was went over really well. But no, bad bagpipes are not good.
Well,
you know, I mean, that's probably where the bumper sticker came from. Yeah. Because I'm in a great pipe band, you know, obviously is pretty amazing to hear and witness. But yeah, bad bagpipes are not fun.
Okay. So at some point... You give this all up. You give the limelight. The Queen visits up to study to study hotel management. Is that right? Or hospitality kind of in general?
Yeah. So because of the travels, of all my travels, I thought I wanted to work in a hotel.
Yeah.
That didn't take me long to realize.
Like it's really different than staying
really
in
like
a hotel.
I really like staying in hotels.
Yeah. Behind the scenes, not as much fun.
Yeah. But after, I mean, like I said, after my parents passed, it was, I just kind of wanted to... I missed something artistic. My mom's side of the family were second generation dairy farmers, West Petaluma. So when I was banished from the house or in trouble, my mom would, you know, ship me off to the dairy ranch and for hard work, right?
Yeah,
and I loved it. I just loved it. I was a kid and, you know, jeans, t-shirt, working hard.
Yeah.
I think that's where the kind of the love of the land, agriculture kind of came from.
Okay. So when did winemaking as a career kind of enter your mind and how did you pursue that?
So it's interesting because I think all kind of what I just, everything I just explained in my childhood, which was pretty intense, all those components led to winemaking, you know, like, you know, playing the piano at the level I did, you know, a lot of attention to detail, you know, kind of memorization, agriculture, you know, from the dairy ranch experiences there. It all kind of led
all the
to
travel,
all the
which
travel.
Is, like, and hospitality. One is hospitality.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. All those little components kind of led to, but it wasn't, I'm not quite sure if it was a conscious decision to pack my bags and move to Healdsburg 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But I knew I wanted, that's what I wanted to, at that time, learn.
Mm-hmm.
I was.
And so why Healdsburg?
You know, that's a great question. I don't remember.
You don't know?
I know there was talk about Healdsburg.
Yeah, my, it looked very different then.
Oh, very.
I mean.
Oh, yes.
Still very much a farming town.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean,
with some rough bars, not some pretend rough bars.
I remember... I remember, I think I was 16. Can't remember exactly what the age was. But my girlfriend drove me in her Volkswagen Bug.
I knew you were going to say that. I don't know why.
To
what color?
Healdsburg, green.
Yep. Okay.
But, I mean, I can't remember. We must have gone 40 miles an hour all the way up 101.
Yeah, right. Overheated
a couple
times.
To a little
times.
Town called Healdsburg.
Yeah.
To pick up my first car. It was a Chevy S10. From McConnell.
Okay. Oh,
and I remember going, we're going where? Like, yeah. And we kept driving and driving and driving.
So far away.
But why Healdsburg as far as wine, I don't remember like what mm-hmm. led me over, you know, over Napa or somewhere else to go.
Yeah, so interesting. Because, yeah, it was incredibly different 30 years ago. I mean, it's changed so much even in, the, you know, the time in the last 10 years,
well,
20 years.
All of
it, yeah. Since, yeah. Yeah, last 5 years, 3 years, yeah. It continues.
Yeah. Yeah, this year.
I know, right? I know.
I think we have to take a break, but we're going to come back and talk more about this winemaking career that you somehow fell into consciously. Back on with our guest, James McPhail, owner, winemaker, McPhail Family Wines, Tongue Dancer Wines, winemaker for The Calling, San Giacomo Family Winery, and We Know Jack. So, yeah, we're trying to get to where this wine career starts. You drive up to Healdsburg in a green bug to pick up a car, and then at some point, you end up as a harvest intern at Kivera. So was that your first job in wine?
It was.
Okay. Yeah. And why Kivera? Was it they were just hiring?
I was just trying to find a job.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And it was like today. It was very hard. It took me, you know, because I did not have the background. So Grady Wan, remember Grady? He was
remember the name.
He was the winemaker GM of Kivera for a long time. And he hired me for harvest. First day on the job, that was it. I knew exactly this is what I want to do.
That's it, really?
Yep. Yeah. And after harvest, he realized that I had, I think, a pretty good head on my shoulders. So he goes, we need a lot of help around here.
Yeah.
So I stayed, and over 3.5 years, the following 3.5 years, I almost did everything.
And so this is early 2000s?
Mid-90s.
Yeah. Okay. So Kivera was a very well-known brand, I think, at that point,
yep.
Making a lot of Zinfandel, mm-hmm. Some different Rhone varieties, known for their farming practices.
Yep.
Good place to land early.
Oh, I couldn't have asked for a better, like, unofficial kind of, you know.
Yeah.
You know, be able to do everything
was
just really instrumental to the next 30 years.
And so that was it. You were sold on winemaking as a career and potentially as Sonoma County as a region?
Yes, I did. I mean, I was absorbing it all. I mean, I just was a kid in a candy store, just loving every day. And I went back to Davis and started that. I did not finish Davis. It would have been my third tour of college, but I was just learning more on the job, you know, and it was...
Yeah,
it was
why stop?
Why stop? And it was the days when Davis was funded by Gallo. And the curriculum was more, you know, lab forward than vineyard forward. And that's when I first was learning, you know, that wine is made in the vineyard.
I seem to remember Mary Edwards being important in your
yes.
trajectory. So tell me that I'm not wrong.
You are not wrong.
And good memory.
Yeah. So there was a couple of, so after like couple of years and, you know, got my feet wet and was learning a lot at Kivera and realized I was going home and drinking Pinot and said, oh, you know, maybe I should go off and work for a Pinot Noir producer. So my first short stint was with Gary Farrell. And then ended up at Pellegrini.
Okay. Yeah.
Where Mary Edwards was making her wines prior to her, of course, building her facility there.
Yeah.
Now. So that was my experience with Mary for a couple of years. Yeah.
Okay. And so what do you think is the biggest thing that she taught you? I mean, she's such a legend in Pinot Noir
gosh.
And clones.
Yeah.
And
between
vineyards.
Gary taught me a lot from the vineyard standpoint. And I remember my first kind of introduction to production for Pinot Noir. But then I really kind of sunk my teeth in with Mary. Like, she really, that's where I taught the most. I learned the most.
Yeah.
Taught me the most and really learned about Pinot Noir production as it is today.
Yeah.
And she was, as we all know, you know, the queen of Pinot Noir. Mm. She was, you know, trailblazing back in those days mm-hmm. of the winemaking practices that we do today.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yep.
And so you start your own brand pretty early on, in my memory. So McPhail yeah. Family Wines was your first foray into kind of like putting your name on a label and mm-hmm. starting your own Pinot mm-hmm. project. Was that 2004? When was that?
2001.
Oh, gosh. So wow. you were really early to it.
Yeah.
And did you from the beginning kind of want to start your own thing, or were you encouraged to start your own thing, or did you like accidentally
nope,
start your own thing?
Accidentally start my own thing. I remember going to Mary and asking her if I could try my hand at it.
Mm.
And, you know, being the queen of Pinot, she blessed me and said, okay.
I love that.
I think she gave me, I don't know if there was a limit, but I think there was like 4 or 6 barrels I could make.
Okay.
Because I know that the you know, the focus could not be taken away too much, you know. So that's when I made my first, I think it was 6 barrels.
Okay. And then that was it. You put your name on it and the little red wagon.
Again, it all just kind of organically happened. I mean, I, of course, you know, coming from a family business and you know, kind of the experience I had, I had a little entrepreneurship in me and, you know, it was classic. You know, I came up with my first vintage and, you know, I had no one else to write but family and friends saying, buy the wine. I was introduced and become friends with Jan Mettler.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember Jan? Mm-hmm, so she was doing the PR for Kyivera. Oh,
yeah, that's right.
And so Boss Dog Marketing.
Yeah, she was very active.
And then, so I learned a little bit. She helped me, you know, get the wines to the press, you know, in the early days.
Yeah, I remember.
And it just organically happened. Like, really, I mean, almost overnight.
Yeah.
Right? Because early 2000s, all of a sudden, you couldn't make enough Pinot Noir.
Your timing was amazing.
Yes.
The wines were amazing. You were working with great vineyard sites.
Yes.
I think I remember you had a very ongoing relationship with Jim Pratt.
Yes.
A lot of his vineyard sites. I remember walking some of those vineyards. Yeah. So, and you were early on to a lot of the cooler climate, I think.
That's where my love was. I went out to Anderson Valley. So in like Toulouse Vineyard, 2003 was my first vintage there.
Okay.
Loved Anderson Valley mm-hmm. the most. And even then it was interesting because, you know, people would say, well, why aren't you getting fruit from here or here? You know, the more established names or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, I want to find my own little gems.
Yeah.
You know? And of course, you know, starting a business, it was, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It was, the price was better.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
yeah, as an early brand, own thing.
Yeah.
Okay. But at some point, that was the only thing that you were focused on for many years or several years was McPhail Family Wines, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then you sold.
I did.
In 2011?
2011.
Okay.
When I sold to the Hess Collection. Yep.
And then you become a consulting winemaker for many brands. Is that right?
2016.
All right.
Yeah.
What were you doing in between?
Well, I stayed on as winemaker.
Okay.
From 2011 to 2016, I was winemaker for, of course, the Hess Collection project.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember Sequana?
I do.
Okay. So that's what they hired me for. And then, of course, winemaker for McPhail. So I had those two projects.
Okay.
Yes.
And then we want to talk about the calling. Was the calling your first sort of outside winery client?
So
how did that happen?
It's kind of a wild story. So the week I became a free agent, when I walked away from the Hess Collection and McPhail, I had two offers. Dan Goldfield called me and said, hey, you've been the winemaker for the calling. I think you would be great to take this over. Mm. And then heard through the grapevine that the San Giacomos were thinking about starting a brand. It all happened in the same week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So you must have been feeling good.
I was, and so was Carrie. There was job opportunities.
Yeah, no, very important and really exciting ones. So because
yes.
both, so Calling was, Dan Goldfield was the original winemaker.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But still pretty early days for that brand.
Yes.
And then San Giacomo had never made wines with their names on it. So completely starting a brand with an established family name from the beginning.
Yes.
Pretty exciting stuff. And you were their guy.
Yeah. I know.
And lots of Pinot and Chardonnay.
Lots of Pinot and Chardonnay, which
for
is really
both those labels. Kind of
the wheelhouse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we have to take another
break. I know, that's what I was going to
say. Yeah. Unfortunately, we have to take another break. We'll be back on very soon with our guest, James McPhail. With James McPhail talking about your big week where you get a call from The Calling and from San Giacomo's to become their winemaker. In the meantime...
And still doing both of those roles.
Yes. Mm-hmm. These are long-standing relationships and stuff. But somewhere along the line, you also couldn't help yourself and you started another brand. Right?
Right. Creatives have to keep creating, I guess.
Yeah, it sure feels that way. So, 2012, you and your wife, Carrie, started Tongue Dancer?
Correct.
Okay.
So, after we sold in 11 and, of course, only sold the brand, we didn't sell the property or the winery, wanted to really just kind of go back to smaller lot winemaking, which was really my love. McPhail had gotten a little big and... and I kind of wanted to go back to those days of, 2, 3, 4, 5 ton lots and keep the relationship with the growers that I had built for all those years. So that's one of the reasons why Tongue Dancer started. We started, I think, 100 cases, I think, in 2012.
Really small. Yeah. Okay. So little baby steps. And how big is the brand now? How many wines are you making?
1,700 cases and we're 100% direct.
Okay. And how many wines? What are you doing? You're doing Pinot and Chard, but also a little rosé?
Five Chardonnays and 6 Pinots.
Okay.
So everything is kind of anywhere from 50 to 150 case lots.
Yeah, really small.
So you're not busy at all during harvest?
No. 92 vineyards this year?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And if you think about where all the calling is, then you go all the way over to sort of Carneros, Sonoma Valley, Sonoma Coast. Running around a lot.
Paso, Santa Rita.
Yeah.
Well, and as if that were not enough, you then boldly bought back McPhail Family Wines.
Yes.
Big deal.
And that just last year. So in 24. Yeah.
That's right.
Very big deal. I mean, we've seen, Patson Hall, they James were able to buy their brand back. This seems to be a very happy and positive trend. Did you know that you were going to be able to do that? How did this happen?
I had been asking for a couple of years.
Okay. So you wanted it back.
I did. Once I really learned that they had, slowed to pretty much stopped production, that's when I started to, write. It was the same day every year. I'd say, are you ready? And graciously they said, I'll throw out a number.
Really?
And so I did, and how all great negotiations start, we were in the same ballpark.
Nice.
So it was, it was pretty...
It was meant to be.
Yeah, it was meant to be.
How are you differentiating McPhail from Tongue Dancer?
So it's Carrie and I need another brand.
Right.
But, the main reason to get it back, of course, was the name, to get the family name back. And secure that. And so this last year for 2024, harvested fruit from the first vineyard, Anderson Valley, Toulouse Vineyard. And so we're going to keep it OG, same label.
Yeah, go back full circle.
And I'm probably going to focus solely on Anderson Valley.
Okay.
That's lovely. So that'll
be the difference. All right.
Yep.
We should probably talk a little bit about how people can try your wines. Can they come visit? Where do they go? How do they taste with you?
Yeah, so we have actually a very unique and special tasting. It's either Carrie or I, Carrie's my wife, and or myself, we'll host the tastings. Everything's by appointment at our winery in Healdsburg.
Nice.
Which is at my house.
Okay, so
you walk out the back door and then
it's
don't
special.
Let yourself into the house.
It's special.
Just go into the winery.
Yes.
That's 851 Magnolia Drive mm-hmm. in Healdsburg. You got a lot of websites. So, tonguedancerwines.com is probably the way they find out how to visit and taste those wines. Your appointment only. Good to know.
Yes.
Tuesday through Saturday, because sometimes you might not want people over.
Well, again, because it's at our house, you know, we try to take Sundays off.
Yeah, there you go. And you can try some of the other wines that he crafts at, sangiacomowines.com and thecallingwine.com. So, lots of wines with James McPhail's touch.
Well, we love your stories. We love all these wines. Thank you so much for sharing with us. And
and I want to hear the bagpipes at some point.
I know. Next time, bring your bagpipes.
How about a piano?
Okay. Fair. All right. Very fair. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
So, Carissa, what would you rather play, bagpipes or the piano?
Piano for sure.
Yes,
please. That's an easy answer.
Yes. Okay. Very good.
No, but what, I mean, I've known James for years, one of the first people I think I encountered when I first moved here. And what a fascinating, I had no idea the kind of the twists and turns creatively in his life of so talented.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think he and being so early to his love of Pinot Noir and Sonoma County Pinot Noir and finding these cool climate
in the mid-90s.
Small spots and learning as he's going. Another inspiration, like we talk about that sometimes. We have people who grew up here who come back, and then we have people who very deliberately came here to follow a path that they wanted to be on.
Yeah, and I love that we can do both of those.
We can do both of those
stories. So.
And in the end, we get wine out of it.
I think so.
No matter what,
which is great.
The path is.
Well,
so.
And that was a great show to start our new year.
I agree.
Yeah. So good stuff, wine.
Good stuff. What are you going to drink on Tuesday?
You know, in honor of James McPhail's fabulous winemaking, I'm actually going to do The Calling. And they actually buy grapes from Sunny View, which is our, I like to say, the Sonoma County Wine Growers home ranch, which is not really true, but it is the vineyard that our office is on, is the Sunny View. So I'm going to do The Calling Sunny View, Pinot Noir.
Do you keep an eye on those grapes?
I do. We actually do a lot. It's fun. I mean, it's actually really fun to have our office on a vineyard. It makes so much sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to be connected.
Much nicer.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to choose the other people who called him that same week.
I love that.
The San Giacomos, who have been making some lovely wines with James over these years. But you tipped me off to a brand new Sauvignon Blanc that they have now, 2023 Amaral Vineyard Sauvignon Blanc. So that's a vineyard Sonoma Coast. I don't know the vineyard, but I really...
I'm going to have to ask Steve about that and Mike. Cause
I think so.
I know. I'm excited. I actually just... I got a bottle, so good thing you're drinking your own, because I wasn't sure if I was going to share my bottle of it.
Wow.
So, I know, right? That's fighting words.
Wow,
just kidding.
Tough around here.
You know I love sharing my wine with you. Always, always, always.
Yes. Well, he's making some great wines. I hope people do go and experience the tasting at his house, essentially.
Yeah, which is cool.
It's very Sonoma County in that way, very intimate and hands-on. So, yeah.
And check out maybe... all the different websites. You can go to sangiacomowines.com, thecallingwine.com, tonguedancerwines.com, or just check out more by him, winesbyjamesmcphail.com.
So many places to check out. Thanks for joining us on the Good Stuff Hour today, everyone. And from Sonoma County to wherever you are, remember to drink the good stuff.
Cheers to that.